Today, we are extremely lucky to have Rajeel Ratman, owner and CEO of Pur Growth Asia, as our speaker. Rajeel is the chairman of the South African Chamber, and he's also very active in the Joint Foreign Chamber Education and Skill Committee, where he's contributing a lot. And as Professor Konkiti said before, and who is also a professor in engineering, Rajeel is somebody who can really lead. Rajeel trained as a clinical psychologist and taught for several years before moving into the corporate world. He worked in South Africa, the U.S., the U.K., and Singapore. He's been based in Thailand for 10 years and has focused on helping leaders lead more efficiently and through complexity. He works with various organizations, from startups and global multinationals to public organizations like the World Bank and UNICEF. He also coaches executive dealing with business challenges. I think some of his experience and some of his teaching could help us through the crisis that we're going through now. He teaches strategy, digital transforming, and negotiation at Sassine Business School. I know that that's very hard work from what he's been saying. He has to prepare a lot, so it's far more easier to teach people like us than it is to teach at the school. And he's also at the Asian Institute of Technology. Rajeel has contributed a lot through JACCT lately, so in spite of being very busy and a one-man show at the work, he also helps students that are less fortunate. We have three pilot projects in the Joint Foreign Chamber of Commerce, and Rajeel, he has some really inspiring workshops where he's, through pictures, through simple explanation, he's teaching them skills of believing in themselves, encouragement, and finding a way forward. I'm not going to say any more. I'm going to give the word to Rajeel. Everybody enjoy. Welcome, Rajeel.
Okay, so I hope you don't mind me talking here. I'm going to try and keep it as intimate and friendly as possible. Vibeka said I do leadership development, and I lecture at Sassine and at AIT. And I think some people get the impression that I stand up there and talk for hours, but that is very far from the truth. Talking for a long time is not really my strong suit. I try and help people learn things through doing activities. So this is quite different for me. I'm going to try and keep it relatively short at about 15 to 20 minutes. But I would love for all of you, if you have any questions, you have any comments, you want to contribute, please feel free to do so. Okay, so I was asked to talk about leading in a post-COVID world, which I think was based on the hypothesis that COVID has created significant challenges in leadership for us to deal with, right? I would partly agree with that, but my sense, having worked with leaders over the last 25 years in a variety on four continents, is that I think what COVID has been doing has been uncovering the flaws that already exist in our system by putting it under stress rather than creating new problems. Because I think what it's uncovering is that the approach that we are taking to leadership in many ways can cause more problems than it solves. So I am going to suggest a slightly different way of doing things, or a complementary or additional way of doing things. But I'll start with why I think there's a problem, right? Most of you are leaders, right? You're all CEOs and CTOs and all of this. And I would, first of all, what I forgot to do is to thank Justin and Roy for and Seven Peaks for having us here. Thank you very much. And to the Norwegian Chamber and Vibeka, thank you. I apologize for not thanking you earlier, but it's really great. I appreciate you giving me the chance to talk. But you and all of the people in this room are all leaders of businesses, of companies, your CEOs, CTOs, CFOs. And so you all know what a good leader looks like, I assume. Or you all know what a good leader should be. Am I right? Yes? Okay.
Not sure.
Not sure. Not sure what a good leader should be. I think that's probably a good answer, right? Because all we know is how we do it most of the time. And we read all of these books and, you know, figure out how other people do it. And there's been, over the last 40 or 50 years, there has been so much research about what makes leadership and what makes good leadership. And I use a lot of that research in the work that I do. Harvard Business Review, for example, will come up every year. Will come up with a new list of things of what makes a leader great, what differentiates a great CEO, and they'll say, yes, delivering with impact, right? What else would they say? They would say being decisive. That's great. I mean, that's a very important one. In fact, they found that people prefer leaders who decide quickly, even if they decide the wrong thing, than leaders who do not decide at all or take too long to decide, right? Leaders who engage their people. Of course, we want someone who's nice and we want to work for, right? There's a whole bunch of criteria that we believe, that based on the research, that leaders should have. And along with this idea that the CEO, the leader of the organization, is the person that will save the organization and take it forward, we also notice that CEO compensation has been going up dramatically. Now, this is a very short little graph that shows the ratio, not the actual salary, but the ratio between the average CEO's income and that of the average employee in the companies that those CEOs run, right? And you can see in the 60s, it used to be about 20 to 1, right? So a CEO would earn about 20 times what? And a lot of this data comes from the US. But you can see what happened in 2000, 360 times, which means that the average worker would have to work 30 years to earn what the CEO earns, right? Now, is the CEO worth that much? Good question. I don't know. Maybe you have an answer. Maybe you think you're worth that much. I don't know. Maybe you are. But I would suggest that this is not really the case. You know, I put a bunch of numbers together. So last year, in the US, it's gone down a little bit from 360 times to about 256 times. So average salary, 53,000. Average CEO salary, 14.3 million, right? In Thailand, it's a little bit better. Average salary, 331,000. Average CEO salary, about 4 million. So 12 times, which sounds a little bit more, you know, palatable. So that would suggest that CEOs are delivering great value, right? And if you're being paid 360 times your average worker, you must be delivering at least that much back to the company, right? But in fact, 30% of CEOs in the Fortune 500 fail within 3 years. Fail, they leave. 2 out of 5 within 18 months, according to Harvard research. And these are people who are walking away with packages worth that much and more for driving companies into the ground, right? And this is despite this $50 billion being spent on people like myself who do leadership development, right? And I will not, I mean, now I teach MBA students, but I'm not going to tell them this. MBAs are more likely to fail as CEOs than non-MBAs, which is a bit of a worry, right? So, but don't let that stop you from studying further. So this seems to be a little bit of a problem, right? I mean, they did a survey on, Harvard did a survey. They followed like these 19 Harvard superstar CEOs. They all graduated with flying colors from Harvard in the 90s. And they followed them for 20 years. 10 of them failed spectacularly. Either got kicked out, destroyed a merger that was supposed to happen, got fired for ethical lapses, whole bunch of stuff. 4 of them did nothing much. And, you know, 5 of them did okay. So 14 out of 19 were not able to live up to this reputation of what a leader is meant to do, right? And even worse than that, the companies that they and we lead are failing and dying at a much faster rate than they used to. So in the 60s, a company, the average age of a company on the S&P 500 was 60 years. I was asking Sfera how old his company was. He said 36 years. That's pretty good, because at the moment, we're looking at the average lifespan of a company being 12 years. So Seven Peaks has been around for seven, right? We're hoping that it'll be around for much longer. If you can beat 12, you're doing really well, right? But this is a worry, right? This is a worry for the companies that we work with. What are these companies doing that causes them to do so much worse in terms of lifespan than the past, right? Is it, and this is all before COVID, right? If you look at COVID, you know things are getting bad. In Thailand, things are getting worse. We've had the worst contraction in 22 years. You know, we've contracted by 12.2% or something like that. You know, the lockdown has affected, affected investments, it affected employment, it's affected tourism. The key driver for the economy at the moment is what? Government intervention. Government investment and subsidies, right? So companies are struggling. And they're struggling not just because of COVID, they're struggling before COVID. And that's why I'm saying that COVID is just uncovering the problems that existed before. So is this because the leaders are not competent or not educated? No. I mean, if you look at the stats, even in the Fortune 500, for example, 40% of CEOs have MBAs compared to 8% of the general population. So they're educated. They know what they're doing. Another little tidbit of information I should tell you is that in the Fortune 500, about 36% of CEOs are over 6 foot tall, which, as opposed to about 6% in the population or 10% in the population, three times as much than in the normal population. Because we have this halo effect. People assume that tall people are brighter and more competent. Right? Doesn't mean they are, but they get promoted into those positions. Right? So we are basing so many decisions on the biases that we have that are to some extent unconscious. Right? So what does that mean for us? Does this mean that people are not competent? No, I would suggest that there are two problems, right? Jean Houston, I mean, she founded this organization called the Mind Foundation, and she's a great sort of leadership thinker. And she said, too many of today's problems stem from leadership that is ill-prepared to deal with the chaos and complexity of today's world where too much is happening too quick. Now, it's an easy thing to say. What I get out of that is there are two problems. Firstly, the world is becoming more and more complex. And it is becoming complex so fast that we don't know, and that's the second problem, our leaders are not prepared to deal with that complexity. So they are making decisions and thinking in ways that would have worked 10 years ago or 20 years ago, but no longer work now. So we have to find a way to change the way we think and the way we approach problems, right? And how do we do that? So there's a really nice framework. This is a Welsh word, Cynefin. It comes from a knowledge management expert called David Snowden, who came up with this word to describe a framework where he identifies four domains of problems and contexts. And he talks about different ways of finding solutions for each of them. Okay. He says, if we cannot classify things, they're a disorder. But most of the time, we can put things into categories and boxes. We can say, things are simple. 1 + 1 = 2. Simple problems are easily solved. So for example, you have a company, you find an invoice that isn't paid. You know the process. There's probably a manual that tells someone what you need to do to go and get that invoice paid. How to find the customer, how to bill them, etc. Right? So it's a very simple process, and best practice works really well to solve that problem. But then you get problems that are a bit more complex, or let's say complicated, which is what he calls it, right? So complicated, like trying to put an IKEA wardrobe together, even using the manual, right? But complicated to the point where you need expert knowledge to solve that problem. So if, as I'm sure some of you drive Lamborghinis and Ferraris, if you hear a knocking in the engine and you're not a mechanic, you're not going to try and solve it yourself. You take it to the garage and you'll find an expert who can solve it for you. The problem may not be simple, but there is a solution that you can find following very clear steps, right? And that is what we call good practice. But what has happened is in the world, and I'm sure you've all heard of this word VUCA, right? Which is the world is volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. We live in a VUCA world, which means the problems that most of the problems that we're dealing with, and the problems, while a lot of the problems fall in this band, there are many problems that are complex. Complex means there are a variety of factors that are independently making decisions and changing and interacting with each other, and we do not have control of all of those factors. So it's the difference between trying to fix a Ferrari engine and trying to fix the rainforest. Because we don't know every single factor that affects the rainforest. And while we're burning it down, we still have no idea how to stop the damage that we're causing, right? And here, best practice or good practice doesn't work. We need emergent practice. We need to try things out. We need to experiment. Eric Ries, who's a serial startup guy, he wrote a book called The Lean Startup. He talks about, I think Justin had it on his slides as well, build, measure, learn, build, measure, learn. Keep trying things out. Step back, try. Because in a complex world, there is no, for the problem A, there is a direct line to the solution B. Because if you're at problem A, there may be six solutions, but the solution may change as you are trying to get to it. So you need to try one step, see if that works, go back, find a way forward, and keep doing that in a cycle. If you don't know what's going on, then you're in chaos, right? And chaos, the clearest example of chaos is February 2020, when COVID hit the world and we had no idea what was happening. And in a situation like that, you can't even stop to think. You act. You do something. So some countries locked down. Some countries said, we don't care about it. We'll stay open. Some countries weren't even sure what they were going to do. They had a whole variety of policies. But there was chaos because they didn't know what to do, so they were trying everything. But pretty soon, we realize sort of what the problem is that we're dealing with. But even when we know, all that happens is we move the problem into the complex box and we have to figure out how to solve it step by step. Because we don't know. It is not a complicated or a simple problem. It is a complex problem that we're dealing with, right? So, but there's a, I don't know if any of you have watched, I'm sure many of you have watched Game of Thrones, right? One of my favorite characters is a guy called Littlefinger. And he said something, so don't worry about that. He said something which I found really quite powerful. Chaos isn't a pit. Chaos is a ladder. If you can find your way out of chaos faster than everybody else, you're way ahead of everyone. So the idea, the question is, how do you do that, right? And the default solution for most of us these days, especially with the advent of digital technology, is let's look at the data, right? Let's figure out what, let's find out from the data what's going on. Let's try and solve it. Let's figure out, you know, how many people are getting COVID and what sort of people are, and let's find and analyze patterns, right? And while data and data analysis is really important, and I think is essential to figuring out the way around the world, what I would say is that we need to be aware of depending on big data alone. We need to be aware because it comes with its own set of challenges. If you, first of all, there is so much data in the world. How do we know what data to look at? How do we know what data is true with all the fake news going around? How do we know we have 4 petabytes of data being created on Facebook every day? 500 million tweets, right? 3.9 billion people using emails, right? There are 4 terabytes of data are created from each connected car, and that's not even a lot of cars at the moment. 65 billion messages on WhatsApp, 5 billion searches. By 2025, it is estimated that 463 exabytes of data will be created every day. I mean, it's a number that I can't even comprehend. Justin, maybe you know better than I do what an exabyte is, but I know it's a lot, right? So how do we use this information? Sure, okay, so maybe we use AI. Maybe we say, okay, let's build an AI that can use its wonderful algorithms to figure out what's going on, right? Sure. But, you know, and I'm not, you know, Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk who think that AI is going to take over the world and kill all of us like a virus. But there are dangers, right? I mean, one of the most public dangers of AI is that because AI is built on human knowledge and human ideas, it can be as biased as humans can be. And we saw that in a system that the Los Angeles police created to try and identify which criminals, once released from jail, would commit crimes again. They found that that system itself was racist, and they had to stop using it because it was based on decisions that had been made on 50 years of human decision-making. Right? So if you can't use just data, you know, what should you be doing? I would suggest that we need to go back to understanding what it means to be human and making decisions from a human perspective. And that's where I come in. So I trained as a psychologist, so maybe I'm biased. But I think the more we try to be objective, I think we should be objective in a lot of situations. When we're dealing with finance, when we're dealing with numbers and rational ideas and issues, I think we should use big data. But I think that there's a whole part of the world and a whole part of leadership that goes beyond just the numbers. Right? So I suggest 3 things. And they're not complicated or big things. And many companies are starting to do this already. Right? The 3 things that I usually teach in my workshops are purpose, sense-making, and empathy. And I'll do a little bit on each of these, and then I will stop. But these 3 things fit together as a model for approaching the world in a human-centered way. This is not to discard the data, but it's to look beyond the data and to look beyond the big data, right? I'm sure you're all familiar with Simon Sinek and Think About the Why and the Golden Circle and all of that. But what he talks about is, whatever we are doing, whatever our company is doing, why are we doing it? Why do we exist? Right? How do we? What does this company make? Is it there to make money? I would say that is a side effect of why we do the things that we do. Elizabeth, you do gemology. You don't do it just because it's a way to make money. You do it because that's what you love doing, to make money. Right? So what is it? What is the fundamental underlying reason for why we wake up in the morning? I think is really important when we try to figure out. And often it gets lost in the how to do things every day, especially because in the business world that we live in, one of the big focuses and one of the big criteria, especially if you're being judged by the market, is how fast are you growing? How much more profitable are you being every year, as opposed to the year before? So I would strongly urge each of us to think about the why. And how do we figure out our purpose? There's a really nice book by a guy called Bill George, who was the CEO of Medtronic, called Discover Your True North, which is about trying to figure out what really gets you up in the morning. And he talks about your crucible moments. He talks about what happened in your childhood, in your early life, that made you who you are today, that made you passionate about something. What was it that drove you in those times? What are those moments that really changed and shaped who you are? Can you think of those things? I'm sure many of us don't think about it, but if we were given a moment, we could think about them, right? What is it that really drove me? I mean, for example, one of the reasons I do what I do is because, you know, I was born in Sri Lanka when I was 5 years old, and I was born to a minority of a minority. My father was Tamil, my mother was Malay, there was a civil war starting, so I was an outsider in the country I was born in. We then moved to Zambia, and I was Asian in Africa, in the middle of a little town. I was an outsider there. Moved to South Africa, outsider. Moved to the US with a South African passport, with a Sri Lankan background, outsider. So, and it took me a long time to figure out what that meant. But I realized that one of the things it meant is that it gave me a different perspective to the people whose communities I was entering. As an outsider, I saw things differently. And I realized that that other perspective can help people. And that's one of the reasons I do what I do. So that for me is a crucible moment, right? But fundamentally, as human beings, the crucible is we are social creatures. We connect. We do things. Purpose cannot exist without service. How is what we are passionate about helping the world? You know, and it sounds very sort of la-di-da and fluffy and soft, but the reality is that the research shows that even people who describe themselves as selfish rate themselves as happier when they are spending money on someone else than when they're spending it on themselves. Right? If I give you $20 and I say, here, go and buy something for yourself. Go buy yourself an ice cream or a nice meal and you'll feel happy. If I say, here's $20, go and spend it on someone else, and you rate yourself after that, you will find yourself at least 20% happier and for a longer time. So what does that tell us about how we should be living our lives, right? So that's purpose. The other aspect is making sense of the world, sense making, right? So there are two general ways to look at the world. And the default way is this inside-out model. We know who we are, we know what our company does, and we try and figure out what do we do that the world wants, and we try and sell it. We find a market for it. You know, we'll build a widget and we'll say, okay, so can we sell it to these people, right? So we base our worldview on ourselves. I propose that a more effective way, especially, this is useful when things are simple, things are certain, and we know what's going to happen. But we know that these days, things are changing so quickly, we don't know what's going to happen in the future. So we need to look differently. Start with the outside. Try and make sense of the world before we try and find our place in it. The inside-out model is based on our assumptions, our biases, our ways of thinking, and we try and fit the world to that. And that's useful in some instances. But the outside-in model takes a more nuanced, empathetic view of the world and tries to understand what is happening in the world before we try and figure out how we can find our place in it. An example of the difference is, you know, we use a process of phenomenology, which is about how people experience life. If you want to learn how to cook, you can read a recipe book. Sure, that's data. It tells you, you know, 15 grams of this, half a kilo of that, put it in for 20 minutes at 300 degrees, whatever it is. I don't know, 300 degrees sounds a bit much. I haven't had an oven in about 20 years. So, but that does not give you what the chef of 20 years who wrote that recipe gives you. Because what he has is he will put things into a pot, he will taste it, and he will say, okay, it needs a pinch of rosemary, half a teaspoon of salt, you know? He knows what it means from his tongue and how he interprets the world. That is how you make sense of the world from the human senses that you have and the mind that you have been given. So it's not just about getting the data right, it's about getting the right data, right? I had a video here that I wanted to show you, but I took it out because I thought it would take too much time. But It was about, I don't know if you've watched that TV show, The Big Bang Theory, right? Which is about these nuclear physicists that live together. And they were having Sheldon, the main guy, he has a seat where he sits. And he doesn't want to sit anywhere else. And he was trying to explain why it was. And he was able to explain in about 5 minutes that he sits here because it's at the right angle to the TV. There's a breeze coming through. He can talk to people. He can look at the TV. He can do 50 other things while sitting in just that spot. And no other spot is good enough for him. Because, and that is about, you know, understanding the world from a much deeper perspective. So sometimes a chair is not just a chair. It is a lot more than that, right? To paraphrase what Sigmund Freud said about sometimes a cigar is just a cigar, right? Sometimes what we see is not all there is. There is more to it. That's the second aspect. The third aspect is empathy. Now, empathy, I'm sure you all know, you've heard the word. We know it's not sympathy. It's about being able to put yourself in someone else's shoes. It's about being able to feel what other people feel. Sure. But beyond that, the true meaning for me of compassionate empathy is not just being able to put yourself in someone else's mind and see what they see and feel what they feel, but through that experience, wanting to help them. It's about being compassionate to your fellow human beings and through your purpose and service, trying to do something to improve the lives, not just of yourself, but of those around you. So I never say try and be sort of selfless at the expense of yourself. But when I teach negotiation, I never talk about trying to get the deal done. What I talk about is how do you try and create the optimal solution for both parties or all parties, which is the idea that you want to have, right? So here's a little video. Sorry, I will show you that video in just a moment. So this is, and the reason I'm showing you this video is for me, there's a longer version of this, which you might want to watch, but it is exemplary of a company that uses empathy in its decision making. Okay? So it's 1.5 minutes long.
Katrina chewed up and spit out much of Gulfport, Mississippi, including the headquarters of Hancock Bank.
See, this floor was completely trashed. It was 100% loss.
I'm just glad to be here.
Bank employee Gay Todd still tears up remembering not what was lost, but what her bank gave.
They looked after the community.
Without electricity, records, or even all its buildings, Hancock started opening the day after the storm, improvising with trailers, folding tables, and faith.
We just made human judgments, and those people that needed help, we gave help.
What kind of help?
Cash.
Waterlogged money salvaged from ATMs and vaults was literally laundered, washed, dried, ironed, and loaned to customers and non-customers alike.
And we would write a little IOU on whatever little piece of paper that you had that you could put your hands on. Little yellow sticky pads, a piece of a napkin.
Marvin Corey got a few $100.
A lot of people's lives depend on being able to go buy gas, ice.
And you needed cash to do it.
You needed cash to do it.
Hancock Bank says millions of dollars of salvaged money was used to make its unconventional Katrina loans. All but $300,000 was paid back. And there were other unexpected dividends. In the 4 months after the storm, Hancock's deposits grew 40%. And in 2009, George Schlobel, the bank chairman during Katrina, was elected mayor of Gulfport with almost 90% of the vote.
Basically, people are honest and want to do the right thing. And they'll stand by you if you do the right thing by them.
Right? So don't give up, keep trying, and try and think about what it is to be human when you make decisions for business. Thank you. That's it.
Thank you, Rajil. Does anybody have any questions for Rajil?
Yes, as I said, my name is Sarah Golden. I've been here for 36 years. And the three of us came all the way from Somorprakan outside Bangkok to be inspired. Which we were, was a great presentation, and it came a piece of an, so I was thinking to myself, well, I'm here now, I'm 71 years old, I'm not going to retire, I'm going to work until I drop my decision, but Esther, we're sitting here to be inspired, all of us, I guess. Is there any way I could contribute to this inspirement? And as I said, sometime in my age, my position, I have ups and downs. What do I do if I want to be inspired? And I'm going to show you that. Hold on one second. When I want to be inspired, I open my YouTube. And I look up a YouTube section called Jack Welch. He has some of the presentation that I admire most of all, and I have it on my computer. Whenever I feel like it, I open up. It's 4 minutes, 40 seconds. And I listen to him. So if you write down, it says, what's the role of a leader? He explains his opinion, being one of the greatest managers in the world, building up General Motors. What is the role of a leader? He explains it in a way that I've never seen anybody else explain it. So if you want to write that down, Jack Welch, what's the role of a leader? Go home, look at YouTube, and be inspired. That's my contribution to this meeting. Thank you.
Okay. Would anyone else like to comment or say something?
You talk about leadership, but what about ownership? I think the bank you showed was family-owned, that's what you said. If it had been owned by private equity owners, it might have been different, right? So, and also you showed how many much more leaders failed since the 60s. I think if you look at ownership, how much more companies were family-owned back then compared to now. And, I think it is a factor. I'm not saying all private equity owners are bad. I'm myself working for a company that's owned by private equities, and it's not bad at all. But many of them are just concerned about money. They don't care about the product. They don't care about the clients. They don't care about anything. One thing, money, and right. Quickly.
And this is something that has been happening since the 80s, and it's the financialization of the economy, where the people who control the money, rather than the people who control the means of production, are the people who are in charge. And you can see that by the way banking and financial services went from being about 10% of the economy in the 60s and 70s to being over 35% of most developed economies today. Now, why is banking so important? All it is managing other people's money. It doesn't produce anything. It doesn't create anything. It doesn't make software, it doesn't produce food. So how did that happen? But you're right, I think that has become a serious problem today, is that it separates us from the purpose that we should have when we do things. That's a great point. Thanks, Anna. Anyone?
If you are an inspirational leader and you have a company, it's a big company, how do you make inspirational leadership flow within your organization?
So one of the big things you need to do is to create ownership at all levels of the organization. And you can only do that if you're willing to delegate not just work, but authority. If you allow people to feel that they're responsible for what they need to do and that they can make decisions, then they will feel a greater sense of ownership. So, you know, the problem, for example, in call centers, the incentives that they're measured by is how many calls can you take, you know, and try and get rid of that person as quickly as possible. Not how do I solve that person, and if the call center person sits and tries to help that person solve the problem, they get penalized, right? So the incentives in a lot of organizations drive people to not take accountability, but just to work towards the incentives that they're paid to work towards. So you have to think very carefully about the structure of the organization, but also giving people accountability to do what they believe is right in a situation.
But if you're the CEO of the big company, right, and you're this inspirational person and you have a great message and you speak with a purpose, you would like your purpose to flow and you would like to hire the right people that would be kind of not exactly like you, but inspirational. So is there a method?
So
how would you get these people in key managerial position to actually be your spokespeople, to also inspire their own people to be more productive and be happy at work?
So I think it would be difficult to make sure that everyone has the same purpose as you, right? In any organization, especially big organizations. But so I do work. So there's two things. Firstly, inspirational leadership doesn't have to be Jack Welch standing in front. And you know, you look at the Fortune 500, and he's a great leader. But the people who's the extroverts who stand in front and talk and be inspiring in an overt way are the minority. The really great leaders in the Fortune you've never heard of, but they lead the biggest companies in the world. They don't stand up and make speeches and tell everybody how great they are. They sit in the background and do the work. And they may be introverts, or they may just be specialists, or whatever it is. So, I mean, there's a saying, I think it comes from China, but this idea that, you know, if you have a good leader, you look up at your good leader and you say, wow, look how much this leader has done for us. If you have a great leader, you say, wow, look how much we have achieved for ourselves. So there's a difference between being inspirational by speaking and being inspirational by action. And creating a structure, right? So that's the one thing. The other thing is also, I do a lot of work, or I used to at least in the last couple of years, with Unilever. Unilever and its previous CEO, Paul Polman, who was Dutch, was very focused on purposeful leadership and purposeful organization. And what they did was they had almost every single manager, and in fact, I think like about half their organization, go through purpose workshops to figure out what is their own personal purpose. Mm. It may be different from the leader, but what wakes me up in the morning, and how do I justify what I do when I wake up in the morning to come to work every day? How do I make sure that I am living my purpose in the organization? So if everybody can do that, then you don't have to talk to them because they're living their own purpose and they're making decisions. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that helps.
No, yeah. It helps. It's a vast topic, but it helps. Thank you very much.
Sure. Okay. Yes.
Exactly what you explained is the by increasing the size of the company, becoming multinational, we create distance between the people on the field and the leader in the organization to try to share a purpose, which may not have a meaning far from the headquarters. And the fact that you always refer to the big figure and you speak about the leader, I think if I were in your situation, or just to refer to your case, I think the first mission is to explain that there is not one leader in the organization. You have to start telling to everybody that they are leader, and there is not only one purpose. You have to create as many purposes as departments, as projects. As what I often say is that actually leadership is about converting a routine job into a project. So go to your CFO, CTO, general manager in Thailand, in Cambodia, in Laos, wherever, and tell them what's your project. And as soon as people start to be in the project mode with a clear vision, a clear strategy, a clear culture, then people start to be engaged not on the purpose of the CEO, which is in US that nobody ever met and doesn't mean anything, but just your own project. And the bigger are the company, and the more distance, and the more we lose this sense of purpose, because what's true in US may not be true at all in Thailand.
And there's a company called Atlassian, which is a software company in Australia, that has every one Friday a month, they have what they call Ship It Days, which basically means on that Friday, you can stop your normal job and work with any team you want, doing any job you want in the company, and try and do a project of your choice. And 60% of the bug fixes that they've come up with and significant portion of the new products they've come up with have come up through those Ship It Days, because people are doing what they're passionate about in the organization. So it's about aligning what they do with what you do.
Just to share an experience, before I was living in Vietnam, we had a factory in medicine, animal medicine, and one day the production manager came to me and he said, I want to get the factory certified, the European certification, which for me doesn't make any sense, because the Vietnamese customer doesn't really care about certifications. So my first answer was to say, I don't see that necessary, it's going to cost money, spend time, and so on. And after I realized, and actually I let him do, and I realized that it became their project, people were so proud to be the first one in Vietnam to get this accreditation. It didn't bring any benefit on a business point of view, but it created their own project. People actually work like hell just to get that certification. It creates a sense of purpose just for them. So I didn't do it internationally, but I realized after that that was actually one way to create a project for them.
And you'd be amazed at how much people are willing to give if they believe in something. If Dan Pink, who talks about motivation, he compares Microsoft Encarta, which was the encyclopedia project that Microsoft started. They hired hundreds of specialists and experts, spent millions on this. It died, and nobody even remembers it. But an encyclopedia that was created for free, by people doing work for free, after their normal jobs, giving their expertise and their knowledge for no money, for no recognition, is the biggest encyclopedia in the world, which is Wikipedia, which we use today. And it's done for free by people who do it in their spare time. And it's because they're passionate about it. Yeah. So, anyone else? Okay.
The question is, when you live in a fast-moving world where people are stressed out, right, like bosses are stressed out and they need you to generate revenue, where is the place for inspiration, respirational leadership? You know, like these people, they probably want to be, they are inspired and they would like to project an inspirational leadership, but how is this possible? Yes, in that context.
So I think that the challenge in a fast-moving world, in a complex and chaotic world, is to try and create space for people to think and reflect. You know, why is the world so fast? Why is it that you need something by tomorrow? Why is it because, you know, the markets are telling you we want your quarterly reports? Is it because your CEO wants to go away on holiday to the south of France and therefore wants to deliver it? Why are we in such a rush? Right? I mean, we live in Thailand. We know that, you know, despite the fact that we have Sabai Sabai here, and we are not as fast as Europe or America, things get done. One of the biggest economies in Southeast Asia, and things get done, and we're really good at what we do. So how does that happen? Right? So I think the first thing that leaders need to think about is, why are we pushing for things? How do we create space for people to be and to think for themselves and to reflect? Because without that time, you are just doing. You're focusing on the how and the what and not on the why. You need time to think about the why.
But then in inspirational, if that's okay, I will ask in inspirational leader, to me, it's somebody who will first and foremost get outside of his comfort zone and get naked in front of their staff and share stories, which to me, I don't see often. That is the number one thing that is difficult to do. Then, yeah, from that point onwards, it's difficult to flow, right?
Yeah.
So there is a strategy to it.
Yeah. There are, so the startup industry came up with a really nice technique because one of the things you need to learn, especially if you're doing build, measure, learn, and you're trying things out, is that you have to become comfortable with failure. You have to create space for people to be able to fail, because otherwise they will never try. If you don't allow them to potentially fail, they will just do what they are told to do and never do anything new, because they fear the failure. So what I have done with some really big multinationals, I won't mention any names, but even in the banking industry, is brought this technology of what they call, I won't use the word, but it starts with an F, F-up sessions. This started in Mexico with a couple of startup CEOs who got together to have a few drinks and just share with each other the worst mistakes they had made, how they screwed up completely, how they lost a $100 million investment, how they lost their first business, what they did. But not just that, but what they learned from it and what they did differently. And within a year, this had become such a big thing, you can now sign up for F-Up events. You can go online and have a look for it. And you can go in and you can listen to people talk about these huge mistakes and failures that they did and what they learned from it. And what that does is it encourages people to say, well, it's okay if I fail, because they survived. You know, they lost their biggest investor, and they survived, and they did okay. Right? So I can try something. So I think creating the space for failure is another thing that you need time to be able to do as well.
Right, yeah.
All right? So, yeah.
Just two comments. The first one, when you start your presentation, you associate CEO to leaders, which I don't always agree. We always consider that CEO are leaders. Actually, I think the main problem, I feel a little bit what you said because I went through the same story. And I think in many cases, actually, the people in top position, they are not leaders. They are just here to manage and to ensure that things are get done. I feel what you feel when my boss, you know, are coming to me every year and say you have to do plus 10%, and every year and every year, and at the end you start to lose purpose, because what's the point of making 10% this year if next year I have to make another one, and where does it stop, and where do I feel accomplishments? It's never finished, actually. And I think this is where you start to have to feel as a leader, take distance from the pressure you get from the top, which whatever you do will still be there. We are not going to change the world. So your boss will still come every year to ask for 10% more. The point is, how do you convert that to your people? If you just do the same and tell them, I'm sorry, my boss asked me 10, so I will have to be obliged to ask you 10 again, then you don't really act as a leader. I think it's don't try to reflect this pressure to your people, but try to translate it into stories. Just to explain to you again my experience, I was in the same situation. I consider my boss was not a good leader, so he was just coming to me with numbers every year, every year, every year. And I just say in front of all my staff, I say, money, I don't really care about money, I don't really care about profits. What I really care, and I translate the expectation from my boss into a new project, what I care is that all together in Asia, we are going to show to the people in Europe how good we are. And this is a project that we have. In marketing, we have the project. In factory, we have the project. In sales, in everything, we have the project, which was not money-related. It was more relying on pride. You know, we are going to show to the people in Europe and in US how good we can do stuff. And obviously, you make your calculation. If that happens, you know that you will deliver the 10%. So everybody will be happy. It's just the way you express it. And this is your job to me in the middle, and not to translate and to transfer what has been coming from the top, but to convert it into, what I say, project. I like the word project, because when you speak project, immediately everybody has in mind a vision, a strategy, a culture, and a performance. When we speak about budget, that's not always the same image you get from that. So I think what I was doing at that time in my job is just to create project for my people, without referring to the budget and the 10% and so on.
Ney Brown talks a lot about being vulnerable, you know, being naked in front of your people, and how powerful that is. And she's got some really nice work on that as well.
Yes, it's a big question. Where do you find the leaders? I mean, we're sitting here also struggling with COVID, we need leadership on top, we need sectional leadership. Where do we find them, and how do we get the feedback that we really found the leader? I mean, how do you define a leader? You know, me and my son, we're working together, you know, and we're looking the whole organization, is there hidden leadership around here? And there is, and we took one guy, quiet guy, everything, promoted him, and he chose us to be a leader. But what is the feedback? How do we find them normally, in your advice? And what is the feedback that we really found them?
That's a great question. I mean, there are theories that leaders are born and not and not made, and I disagree with those. You can learn to be a leader, and I think if you're given the right context and the right environment, most people can find the leadership in themselves. Now, this is not to say that everyone can be a manager or run a company or anything like that, but within the context that they have, they can lead. And I think it's about trying to encourage that in people. And I know that's not necessarily easy, and I don't think it's an answer for everything. But what I think is that in most instances, you can find leadership in your own companies rather than developing it, rather than hiring it in from outside. Professor Gunkit.
Kumaraju, I wanted to ask the differences between control and inspiration. I'm going to give you an example of Thai Airways International. Okay. I was working with Thai Airways International, and they set up the branch, you know, Puff and Pie, which is like a bakery shop of Thai Airways. And they set up revenue per square meters. They set up the goal. And for example, they have a branch at Kasey Sad University where they sold out everything by 11 o'clock in the morning. Okay. But then if you went to the Puff and Pie shop on campus at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they all took a nap, they play games, because they meet their goal. They met their goal. So they did not need to order more. So they sold everything by 10:30 or 11 o'clock, so you couldn't find anything else. The shop was closed. So they meet the target. However, at the end, they have to close the shop because they raised up the goal and they could not meet the goal. So in your opinion, what would be the fine differences between being in control or being inspired, you know, to others? Because you want to control, but at the same time, you also want to inspire. And what are the differences? And that's what Thai Airways International had the problems, because they tried to use a indicator, KPI, they try to set the target, they try to control, and they believe this is a way to inspire. But I think Puff and Pie is a good example. They saw everything by 11 o'clock, but then people became lazy. I asked them and said, how come you didn't want to order more? I said, I met my target. Why do I have to work harder when I met the target? So I would like you to provide your opinions. What are the differences and how would you overcome the mindset of being in control and being in the inspirational area? Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe I can just share a story. I don't know, some of you may have heard of a guy called Ricardo Semler. He wrote a book in the 90s. Brazilian guy who took over his father's company. His father's company made shipping pieces for ships, equipment for ships. Right, and they had contracts all over the world, but recessions were coming, and basically his father wanted him to take over the company. He'd gone and been educated in the US and he'd come back, and he said, okay, I'll only take over the company if you let me do whatever I want. Now, this was a traditional command and control company. The leaders knew what they wanted, they sent down the targets, and everybody did what they were told. And, sorry? They were not leaders, no. Ricardo Semler came in. He was like 28 years old at the time. He's done his MBA. He's come in. And he changed the whole system to the point of, he said, okay, from now on, everybody is responsible in this company. And that doesn't mean I'm just telling you that you have to hit your targets. I am telling you, if you are a member of this company, you can see all our books. You can see how much profit we make. There are no two books. You can see the salary of everybody in this company if you work for this company. And every team can set its own targets and set its own salaries. It's a bit shocking, right? And this happened. This is not like an imaginary story. This happened in the 90s. And the book that he wrote is called Maverick, and it's really amazing. If you don't want to read the book, you can find the TED Talk. But he handed over all authority to everybody in the organization. He said, our board meets once a month. We have two seats open for anybody who wants to come. If you're a cleaner, if you're a factory worker, if you get there and there's a free seat, you can come in and you can have a vote like every director because you're part of this company. And giving them the opportunity to do that turned a company that was about to go under because they lost significant contracts into a company that moved away from just shipping into doing a whole bunch of other significant projects and equipment and survived through three Brazilian recessions, right? So being inspirational is not about you being in control. Being inspirational is about giving up control, I would say. I don't know if that answers your question, Prof. I mean, it's an extreme example, but it's a very powerful example of what can happen if you are willing to give other people responsibility and accountability. Yes.
I think that's the Scandinavian way of living, empower people to do the right thing, and that's what we see in those societies. So I would love to hear how Norwegian leadership style is like and how that is helping navigate through the current crisis.
That's a lovely question.
You made a difficult one, yeah. So sorry, the question again is...
what is Norwegian leadership and how is it helping us get through the crisis?
I think one thing is from being from Bergen in Norway, is one, we're very direct and honest, for better and worse. So I think in some ways it works very well. But I think for us, at least we are direct. We say what we think, and we do empower people. We give people a lot of opportunities to grow and empower themselves. And then, of course, we need to figure out how we can get people to that point, right? And again, I'm also recently started doing a lot of these kind of leadership books, and I'm very inspired by your talk now. I'm also just started my business together here with Roy, and we're learning by doing. And for sure, there's a lot of good insight being shared today that is very useful for us. So I'm far from an expert. I'm very happy to learn from all of you guys.
Back to the corona. You think it's a difference after corona regarding leadership? Will it be a change?
I think what this crisis is doing, I think I mentioned at the beginning, I think it's just bringing out into the open the problems with the current system that we have. Of corporates and leadership and measurements and targets and financialization, and it's showing that as a human race, this doesn't work. We need to think differently, which is why startups.
But you mean the corona, because sort of BI impulse that changed it?
I think it's a trigger that's making things happen faster than they would have otherwise. Definitely. Yes.
What about during the corona? The corona could be less. 2-3 years, maybe? What will happen to the corona? How is the leadership?
How will post-corona affect leadership?
Is there any already some... Is it already some sort of understanding of what changed or what have changed already in leadership?
I'm not sure we can see close up. I think we can only really judge in hindsight. At the moment, if we're looking at how leadership works, we can see the leaders that have succeeded to some extent. And, you know, most of the leaders, the national leaders that have succeeded are women.
But do they succeed whatever situation, whatever condition? Also, it doesn't matter. The corona, of course, matter.
Sorry, I'm not...
Yeah, the corona matters. They are not... Also, you think the leaders are leaders of whatever sort of condition, whatever sort of environment. It is just our leaders, or I guess the corona really matters. Which leaders is the right leader? How do the leaders accomplish?
Who will be
a good leader? Who not a good leader? Corona has a meaning.
I think you need different leaders for different contexts, or different types of leadership for different contexts. You know, even with nations, you need a different leader during war than you need during peace. That's why Churchill couldn't succeed after World War II, because he was a wartime leader, and his style worked for a certain situation, but didn't work for another. So maybe crisis leadership and the way we deal with corona may be different from how we deal with post-corona.
So it means that the leaders have changed, or it means that the leaders vanish and new leaders come? That is sort of
I think leaders need to change or they will vanish, yes.
What about corona and about the moral? Is it okay to earn money on the corona as a leader to sort of go for the normal way of working, normal sort of targets? Is it okay?
So I don't think earning money is immoral at all. And I don't think making a profit is immoral. I think that's a completely fine thing to do. But I think what's important is to try and figure out that if you are trying to make money, how are you doing that in a way that is helping the people around you?
Should you adjust it because of the corona? Your target?
No, I think you should adjust it because you're human, not because of the corona, no. I don't think corona is just just something that happened. It's not important in sort of a long run.
No,
it doesn't matter.
No, it's just a crisis like any other. It just happens to be a very deep crisis. Yeah.
Is there any other questions? Or I think I want to answer to what you said actually. During the corona time, I think we're going through a process. So as a leader, you're first in a bit of a shock. You don't really know what's going to happen tomorrow. And I think when the corona came, nobody of us really realized how big it's going to be. We now know that it's going to be a process of somewhere between 1 to maybe 3 years. And we need to adapt. And what I've seen during this time is that leaders who never would speak to each other before, they have conferences and they talk about how to find a solution, how to move forward. You will find countries working on a vaccine together. You will find chambers working together. We are here today. We're always trying to find ways to anticipate what tomorrow is going to bring. As a leader, you need to be far more flexible now. You can't go in and have your routines. You will arrive in the morning and you will say, okay, you know, what's this day going to bring me? You know, what problems are, or not problems, I don't like the word problems, which challenges am I going to face today? I'll give you a little bit background on who I am. I have a jewelry manufacturer. I have 160 people working for me. I am also the vice chair of the Thai Norwegian Chamber of Commerce. I'm also the vice chair of the Joint Foreign Chamber of Commerce. And I spend, these days, I spend probably 30% on my company and the other 70% on trying to find a new normal for all of you and for myself. And I don't mind it. Because I know that without people working together and without trying to find ways to what the new normal is going to be, finding ways to change, not solutions, but you know, finding ways to, you know, challenges, how to keep my staff. Downsize is a opportunity, no, a possibility, but I don't want to downsize. I want to keep my staff. So first thing was to pull all my staff in, and I say, okay, we're in this together, which means are you willing to go down in salary for a while? I went down 30%, the middle management 25%, and the others 20%. We did that for 3 months. After 3 months, I could see the pain that it gave them. But I really appreciate that they did it. So they went back to full salary. But I said, you know, you go back to full salary. But since I'm the boss in this company and I'm the leader, I'll still do the 30%. Does money matter? Yeah, I think you need to set an example. You can't just go out and spend left and right and think that the staff who was really, you know, giving a lot of, you know, they're investing their time in your company, they're believing in your company, but it's not your company, they're believing in our company. I always say that my staff is a team, we're a family, and a family will take care of each other to the bitter end. Right now, I'm in an amazing situation. Jewelry production, Christmas season coming, I thought Christmas wouldn't come, but Christmas did come early, so I have close to $1 million worth of orders right now. And I have a luxury problem where I don't have enough staff. I've already told my staff that there's no bonus this year. We need to tighten the belt. But today I went down and I said, okay, we're in this together. Let's fight. Let's work overtime. Let's push. Let's find solutions. If we can manage to break even, you will have a bonus. That's a way to inspire them. You know, you need to inspire the people around you. You can't just think that you can solve all the problems by yourself. So as chambers, you know, not to talk about myself all the time, as chambers, I think that we have a role. Rajil is the president of the South African Chamber, and I think we have a job to listen to our members, to find out what challenges you have, and then to go out there and try to help you to find solutions. We can't solve your problems, but we can definitely connect some dots. So if anybody has any questions to the South African Chamber or to the Norwegian Chamber, please feel free to contact us. And on that note, thank you again for Seven Peaks for this venue. And thank you, Rajil, for really an inspiring talk. I really appreciate it. And I think listening to the questions that came here, I think most of us did too. Let's give him a hand.